This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, this is Gary Clinton, and this is Night Transmissions number 54. I'm glad you could make it. You know, sometimes the programs that I air here, well, between you and me, they're not really the best. It doesn't keep me from airing them, I mean. It's part of the whole thing. The good with the bad. And I love them all anyway. I mean, because you've got an ugly child, you don't love that child any less, do you? I mean, if you do, you feel guilty about it, don't you? But the first show tonight is no sort of ugly duckling. It's a splendid show called Crime Classics, which ran in the mid-50s, which was an interesting mixture of history and drama and criminality. This one tonight is a dandy. It's about the Younger brothers. You know, Cole Younger, Bob Younger, Jimmy Younger, that group. It picks up with Cole Younger's earliest involvement with Quantrell's Raiders and his general dislike of the Jayhawkers. Turns out he had pretty good reason, really. That's one thing about this show. The history really does seem to be pretty accurate. At least what little I know about the subjects isn't really contradicted. I'm not pretending to be any kind of a real expert here. But when preparing the show notes, which, by the way, can be found at www.nighttransmissions.com, I spend a little bit of time looking into the history of the shows themselves. I usually get a feeling for the level of historical accuracy on a given show, when it seems to me like it matters anyway. In the case of Crime Classics, it's been pretty good so far. If I ever come across a show where it's not, I'll tell you about that too. Well, it's a 30-minute show. So there really isn't a lot of detail. Like I said, it starts out with just before Cole Younger joins Quantrell's Raiders. Stays with him as he wanders into the position of a Confederate soldier. Then it pretty much jumps directly into the events of the Northfield, Minnesota robbery, the details of which are known to most of us. This is the one where the Younger brothers got together with the James gang and went off and had a major disaster. It makes for interesting listening, even though I think it'll make you reflect on just how often history is the history of crime. It did me. And I'm going to shut up now. So here it is from January the 6th of 1954.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Highland with another true story of crime. The Younger brothers, why some of them grew no older.
Crime Classics, a series of true crime stories from the records and newspapers of every land, from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Highland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, teller of murders. Now once again, Mr. Thomas Highland.
Before the Civil War, there was a border war. The boys from Kansas took gun to hand and shot up the boys from Missouri. And the next Saturday night, vice versa. It got so they didn't wait till Saturday night. Every day was bloody day for everybody. The question now arises, why? The answer is simple. A difference of opinion about slavery. And they couldn't wait till war was declared. Raid and pillage and slaughter in bloody colors smeared on in bold brushstrokes. And one day, through this never-never land of pistol and knife and torch, there walked a young man. His name was Cole Younger. He was leading a horse and buckboard, and when he came to a certain shack by the road, he was at the end of his journey. People around saw he wasn't armed, so they let him through. They saw his face and the look in his eye, and they let him through.
Ain't you learned to knock on a door, sonny?
You're Mr. Quantrell, ain't you?
I admire politeness in young men. You try not
to... My dad is dying on a buckboard outside. You come see.
I seen dying, sonny.
You come see.
All right. He's dead, sonny. I'm sorry.
Shot him while he's standing there just talking to him. Just saying why were they on his land. Shot him because he raised his voice to them.
Kansans?
Jayhawkers from Kansas. North boys.
What are you needing, sonny? A burying for your daddy?
A burying's a private thing, and it's a thing I'll do myself, Mr. Quantrell. When are you riding into Kansas to kill you some Jayhawkers?
Tonight, maybe.
After I bury my daddy, maybe?
Soon after that.
I'm coming with you.
Of course you are.
Not right after he buried his daddy, but soon after, Cole Younger had to take an oath before he became a member of Quantrell's Raiders. It was called the Black Oath, black being the color Quantrell admired most, since it suggested death and danger. The candidate was placed between four men clothed in black, wearing hideous masks representing the devil. First, these men clattered long, keen swords together, then pointed one at the candidate's throat, one at his heart, one at his arms, one at his feet, while the oath was spoken.
The purpose of war is to kill. I will fight because I want no other occupation. I will tear down, waste, and despoil my enemies. By the powers of darkness here under the black arch of heaven's avenging symbol, I pledge and consecrate my heart, my brain, my body, and my limbs to exterminate Federals, Jayhawkers, and their abettors. And if I fail in my oath, may an unmerciful devil tear out my heart and roast it over flames of sulfur.
Well, by the time war came, Cole Younger was 2 years older. He was Quantrell's first lieutenant. This rise from the ranks because he was a smart lad, a reader of books, a blower up of ammunition trains, a burner down of farm buildings, a pillager par excellence, a murderer meticulous, in that he only shot males, and mostly always from the neck up. An exception to this last was the time in Lawrence, Kansas, in a bar, on Christmas Eve.
You a drink, one and all, so step up to the bar. And you're my friends, one and all. Ain't that so, Billy? Billy? Drunken friend, Billy. You sleep so sound, Billy. And don't you too, Johnny. You sleep because you got no sleep at Shiloh. Tell them how it was at Shiloh, should I? Listen, all of you, all around.
Jack.
You step right up and have a drink, courtesy of me and Bill and Johnny and the Union Army.
Yank.
Huh?
What you doing around these parts?
Sent us out here to get us Quantrell.
What's your name?
Martin, Wallace Martin.
A sergeant from the stripes on your uniform.
And my drunken friend Billy's my corporal.
You've
and...
seen a lot of killing, ain't you?
Didn't you hear? We were at Shiloh.
Were you brave at Shiloh?
Huh?
Brave. Like you are now.
What are you talking about?
Talking a streak just before you're gonna die.
You ain't too tall a fella to be talking. Oh.
Billy. Corporal Billy, wake up. Now you come on, open your eyes, Bill. You see this, Bill? Johnny, Yankee Johnny. You're a bright one, up and ready. Why you shivering, Johnny? Why you shivering so? Merry Christmas to one and all.
John Younger, aren't you?
Yeah, but what's the idea of all you men busting in here?
Vigilantes.
But you won't hear.
Cole Younger's your brother, isn't he?
Yeah.
Where is he?
He ain't here.
Where is he?
Fighting a war.
Shooting three men down, two of them sleeping, ain't fighting a war. Where is he?
I told you.
Pinkert! Throw that rope over that rafter. Where's your brother, John?
Look, I don't know where Cole is. Texas, maybe. Louisiana, maybe.
All right, man.
You want me to holler. You want me to scream mercy. Well, hang me and see if I do it.
All right. All right, John. You're biting a lip when I put the noose around your neck, but that ain't hollering, is it, John? And drawing it tight. You ain't hollering either. Where you hiding, Cole? All right, Pinkett. Let him down. Loosen the rope a little, John, so you can holler. Or tell me where Cole is.
You'll rot before I tell you. You'll rot. Before I tell you.
Regular brother to Cole, ain't you?
Try me.
I just tried you. The end of a rope.
A dozen of you did that. One at a time.
Wait, cut!
Wait.
All right. All right. We'll wait.
You're going to kill me? I got to say something. I got to tell you about Cole. Why, if you were licking his boots, you'd be in the right relation to him. He's fighting for what he knows in himself.
The throat right. Your brother isn't a bloodletter and... Kicker, are you? That's good. That's very fine. Because now you'll kick high ones and low ones in the air all around. Pinkert!
But they didn't hang him until he was dead. They hung him till just before he was dead, and then let him down, and beat him up, and left him. But they didn't find out where Cole was, and that spunky brother of his knew all the time where Cole was, in the hills not 2 miles away, down the road and through a pass and up a hill and 2 miles away.
Hi, John.
They came looking for you, Cole.
They tried to kill you.
Did a thing with a rope.
Here. Thing like that, and you didn't say a word, did you?
I'm coming along with you, Cole. From now on.
That's good.
You are listening to Crime Classics, and your host Thomas Highland.
Mom, can I take this can of juice back to the store and keep the money?
Why, yes. But what made you think about doing that all of a sudden?
Well, heck, Mom. They got a big sign in the store about it. They're paying real money for this used fat now.
Yes, you may be surprised at how much dealers are paying for used fats these days. It soon counts up. You see, used fats are still needed very much. This country and the whole world are still short of oils for making soap and other industrial products. So whether you let Junior keep the change or use the money to cut down your grocery bills, it pays to save every drop of used fat.
Now once again, Thomas Highland in the second act of Crime Classics and his report to you on the younger brothers, why some of them grew no older.
On April 9th, 1865, General Lee surrendered, and the war was over. A thing happens when a war is ended. A pall hangs over the land, and then suddenly there's a maelstrom of activity. Returnings, accountings of gains and of losses, dead battles fought again on saloon tables, lost legs bragged about, the blinded eye, the maimed arm, the victory ball and the brain shocked from its moorings and adrift. And finally, the bright young men funneling into the area of sorrows and devastation. To sell, to cheat, to build. Which was Missouri in 1866?
Six of them Yankees, Cole.
Yeah, and one shot scared them.
All right, men, get them! That don't look like none of them are armed, Cole.
Yeah. Who's speaking for these men?
I be.
Who are you? What the six of you doing riding here?
I ask you the same question. What's 50 of you doing stopping us? There must be 50 of you.
I'm Cole Younger. That one over there is John Younger. That's my brother, Jim. And Bob is...
The Younger boys, huh?
That's right, mister.
I hear you believe the war ain't over.
Yes, you believe like me. Else why are you riding in uniform?
Well, you're not a simple man from what I heard, Younger. You know why we're uniformed. We're riding to Indians.
John.
Go.
Hang him, John.
In the name of heaven, you wouldn't hang the six of us.
John.
Go.
The wind and the rope. You remember... Cole Younger and his brothers hanged six soldiers. You might ask how come Bob and Jim Younger were with Cole and John all of a sudden. Well, they were. After the war, there was a reunion, and the four of them decided to cast lots together, as the saying goes, to join forces, to butter their bread all on one side. Anyhow, for the next 10 years, the brothers Younger robbed and killed and burned. John Younger was shot down by a detective in St. Clair and was buried near there. Then... On the 7th of April, 1876, in a shack on the skirts of Northfield, Minnesota.
It's them, Cole.
All right, Bob, open the door for them.
Come on in, boys.
Hi, Jesse.
Hello, Cole. You met my brother Frank, haven't you?
Sure, everybody knows everybody. James, boys, Jess, and Frank.
Cole.
Uh-huh.
You told your boys how we're gonna do that bank?
Don't you worry about it.
I ain't worried about nothing, Cole. I just asked you a question.
Don't worry, Jess. They'll do what they gotta do.
They'd better. Everything ready?
Sure.
Town people having that political meeting like you said they would be?
Yes, I know.
Then we don't have to wait for nothing.
For nothing at all.
Cole.
Uh-huh.
A lot of money in that bank. That's good. Me and Frank talking about retiring for a little while. Going to Mexico.
Hey.
Huh?
Sniff.
What are you smelling, Cole?
Too empty.
Yes.
Just said too empty, that's all. You and me, Jess, Bob and Frank. Rest of you, wait.
Stick up, mister. Just slide everything you got through the window. Back of the window, Jess. See, he's not cheating.
All the money, ma'am. And don't scream. Just don't scream.
Not the silver, mister. Silver's too heavy to carry.
Come on, come on.
How you and Frank doing, Bob?
Good, good.
Let's get out of here. Come on, Bob, Frank.
Okay, boys.
Now, just don't gallop till we turn the corner. All of us galloping might disturb that meeting at...
What's the matter, Cole?
Too empty. Like I said.
Nothing to shiver about, Cole. There's a meeting.
Plan kind of empty. That's what these streets are... Look there, boys! Run! Run!
The bank robbery at Northfield was the turning point. The instant that the townspeople, instead of being at a meeting, had formed a posse and ambushed the outlaws, the bringers of terror became fugitives. The younger brothers had never turned tail and run before, nor had the James boys. But some loop in time, some coordinates of chance, conspired that they retreat at exactly the same moment. At darkness, they lost their pursuers, but they kept riding. It was not until almost midnight that they found a hiding place.
How's your arm, Bob?
Hurts. Lucky we got away, ain't we, Cole?
We haven't done it yet.
Jim hurt bad.
Can't ride no more.
Dying?
Maybe.
Cole.
Yeah?
Jess is fuming. I walked over in the clearing a minute ago. Him and his brother was teasing with Jim.
Take us a walk, huh? Hi, Jess.
Just looking at your brother here, marveling.
Oh?
How's he staying alive?
That bothering you, son?
Well, I'll tell you, Cole. Yeah, it is.
Jesse?
You talking at me, Bob Younger?
Tell my brother Cole what you've been saying about Jim.
I've been saying, Cole, your brother Jim be better off dead. Better for a lot of people.
Like who?
All of us. So we can get on our horses and start riding. How long do you think it's going to take that posse to catch up with us?
The truth is, Jesse, I haven't thought about that.
Well, now, just you think about it.
Jim can't ride, Jess.
That's what I've been saying.
What do you think we ought to do with him?
Leave him.
Oh?
Or shoot him. I'd shoot him.
Jess?
Uh-huh.
You're a dog, Jesse.
Oh, you think so, huh?
I'll tell you what else I've been thinking.
Tell me, Cole. Tell me real fast so you can get it out.
Thinking how it would be we drew on each other.
Be pretty with me.
Want to try?
Be pretty with me.
Stop! Stop it! You two loco killing each other? That's what would happen, you know it.
What do you think, Jesse?
I think maybe your brother Bob is right. But you want to try. Here I am.
You get going, Jesse.
You gonna stick around for a posse?
Maybe. Just you get going.
Not because you're saying it. Because I think it's a thing to do. Come on, Frank.
Jim. Can you hear me, brother? Your smiling makes me know you can. Now, don't you talk.
Coolness to your head.
Don't you worry. Nobody's going to leave you. We're going to take care of you, Jim. Get a doctor to you.
Somehow, they eluded the posse from Northfield, and Jim got stronger, and they rode. There were four of them,
Cole Younger and his brothers Jim and Bob, and a man named Charlie Pitts. Across Minnesota they rode and into Iowa. And now there were posses everywhere, some numbering 1,000 men. And they couldn't catch the Younger brothers. Rewards and promises by bankers and sheriffs and governors. And they couldn't catch the Youngers. The brothers, as far as anyone could tell, were headed into Missouri. But no one could catch them.
Think I got one of them, Cole.
And me too.
Think there was only two?
You cover me, I'll go make sure. Thought I got you before, Sonny.
Not my pride.
Guess me and my brother both got him. You hurt bad? Crazy to try to ambush us. Only two of you, son.
Reward.
What are they offering for us?
Thousands. I don't know.
And you and your partner wanted to kill the Younger brothers.
Everybody.
They all out after the Younger brothers, huh?
Everybody.
Mm-hmm. You hurt?
Hurt.
You didn't deserve better, kid.
Two of them, Cole?
Like you said, kids.
Kids. How old are you, Brother Bob? Yeah. It's a long way.
Bob, get out! Must be hundreds of them. Get you, Bob, Charlie. I'll go look after Jim.
Ow!
You hit!
Just keep shooting!
And at last they were surrounded. Charlie Pitts was killed almost at once, but the Younger brothers held off 100 men for hours. Finally...
Right up! Shot to pieces!
And they truly were shot to pieces. Cole had been shot 11 times, with one rifle ball under his right eye. Jim had 8 buckshot and one rifle ball in the body, plus the shattered jawbone he'd received at Northfield. And Bob's arm was practically macerated. So they were captured... 7 years of plunder, hate, and murder. Done now. The Younger brothers leashed. Finally. They were tried and sentenced to life imprisonment in the penitentiary at Stillwater, Minnesota. Several newspapers tried to get Cole Younger's story, and here is a copy of the letter which he wrote to one of them.
Dear sir, without intending the least disrespect, permit me to say, positively I will have nothing to do with writing a history of any kind. As for anything since the war, a true statement would fall flat. I look upon my life since the war as a blank and will never say anything to make it appear otherwise. The world may believe what it pleases. I have nothing to say unless it would be a request, using the language of Othello. Speak of me as I am. Nothing extenuate, nor set down aught in malice. I was a soldier and fought to hurt, but I never molested a non-combatant. Truly yours, Coleman Younger.
Bob Younger died in prison in 1889. Jim and Cole were released after 25 years. In 1902, Jim committed suicide in a hotel room in St. Paul over an unrequited love. Cole lived until 1916, a quiet life. He sat on a front porch in Lee's Summit, Missouri, and whittled and rocked and talked to hardly anyone at all. But he thought a lot.
The Younger Brothers, tonight's crime classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. The music was composed by Bernard Herrmann and conducted by Lud Gluskin. And the program is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Hyland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. In tonight's story, Jack Edwards was heard as Cole, Sam Edwards as Bob, and Jimmy Eagles as John Younger. Featured in the cast were Barney Phillips, Clayton Post, Bill Bissell, and Walter Tetley. Bob Lamond speaking.
Well, this brings us to our first break. Hey, I'm sorry, but I gotta do it. Look, I'm just gonna play some music, okay? The next show is a mystery. I mean, really a mystery. It's another one of those old-time radio shows about which next to nothing is known. You may wonder how it is that we can have a show and yet not know anything about it. Well, it's because of transcriptions. You see, that was how old-time radio was usually distributed. They would make a transcription, and the transcription was not, as you may think, since you belong here in the 21st century, a process of taking people's words down and committing their testimony to paper. It really simply means a recording. There were several media available for transcriptions. The very earliest ones were really just aluminum disc, roughly the size of a 78 record. That's assuming you know what a 78 record looks like. And if you don't know what a 78 record looks like, I guess that's possible. Do you know what a vinyl album looks like? I'm sure you know what a vinyl album looks like. They look a great deal like a vinyl album. Although, as I said, they were made out of aluminum. Later on, the aluminum would be coated with acrylic acetate to make them look even more like vinyl records. I'm not saying this was the objective, it's just how the process evolved, how it turned out. During World War II, there was a shortage of aluminum, so the media was glass. I don't imagine too many transcriptions of radio shows committed to glass have survived, but a few have. Then came wire recorders in the early 40s, I believe, to be supplanted relatively quickly by tape recorders. First reel-to-reel. I don't know if they ever did much with cassettes, because by that time, I think transmission over telephone lines became more common. Today, syndicated programs are, I think, almost entirely transmitted over satellite. So anyway, that's how we can have a show that we don't know much about. Somewhere, somehow, somebody found this pile of transcription discs that have no provenance. Yeah, I know. Provenance is a word that antique dealers use. It really just kind of means a documented history. You know, sometimes they were found in people's private collections after they passed on, and the family would have really absolutely no idea where the recordings came from. Other times, collectors would find them on sale at garage sales, or Goodwills, or any place like that. A lot of them were found in the attics and basements of radio stations. I've read a few accounts of collectors having wandered into literally backwater spots in Kentucky or Oklahoma or Arkansas to discover substantial collections in the possession of people who really didn't know what they were. Didn't really know where they came from. The truth is, collectors find these old transcription discs in the damnedest places. So if the show in its presentation had no information about who wrote it, or who directed it, or who the stars were, well, it's all lost to history. The Haunting Hour, as I said, is one of those. About all that anybody knows about it is that it was produced sometime between 1945 and 1947.
No. No, stay where you are. Do not break the stillness of this moment, for this is a time of mystery, A time when imagination is free and moves forward swiftly, silently. This is the haunting hour. Breakdown. Sybil Wells' gray head lies wearily on her pillow. Her eyelids are closed, as if it were too great an effort to lift them. She can hear Dr. Adams and her nurse talking, but they seem distant, remote, much farther away than the thoughts in her own brain.
She'll be all right now, nurse. Just give her this every hour.
Very well, Dr. Adams. It's amazing she's pulled through, isn't it? I've been ill. Very ill. For how long, I could not even guess.
It was a close call, but then she's always had a good constitution. I've known her for many years.
Since I was 20. Since before it happened to Father.
No, it's not her physical health that worries me. She's always been high-strung, nervous, like her father was. Before, well, I suppose you know.
Not my physical health. What does he mean? Why must he tell her that Father died in an insane asylum?
Poor Mr. Courtney. His family had to commit him. Mad as a March hare, of course. But each time I'd visit his cell, he'd plead that he was sane.
Yes, he'd plead he was sane. And his eyes would be wild and desperate. And dead of hope.
Sybil, I'm not mad. You're the only one who loves me. Who cares if I live or die? Please, make the doctor understand. I've been railroaded here, Sybil, because I had money and they wanted it.
Oh, Daddy, I have to go now.
You don't believe me. You don't believe me either.
Oh, of course I do.
No. Oh, Lord, if you could only know how it feels to live among these dead and be considered one.
Oh, Daddy, please, please. I must go now. Goodbye.
Oh, Sybil. Sybil, I swear I'm sane. Sybil, I'm sane. I swear.
Tragic case. Well, I'll drop in tomorrow to see how she's doing.
Madness. The horror of vacuum. I guess I'd always feared it. I was sitting up in bed now. Except for the weakness, I could hardly recall that I'd been ill. Good morning, Nurse Kern.
Good morning, Mrs. Wells. I'll take that breakfast tray. And I think you're well enough to have the morning paper if you wish.
Oh, thank you, thank you. I haven't seen one for weeks. I settled back against the pillows and began to read. Earthquake, followed by fire, was yesterday for 33 miles along the shore. 14 people were many more injured. Authorities have the damage, $4 million. It didn't make sense. I read another sentence, and then a different article. What was wrong with me? Oh, of course, my eyes. I've been ill for so long, that's all it was. Nurse! Mrs. Curran! Mrs. Nurse, will you please read this newspaper to me?
Why, of course. Is anything wrong? You look so...
Oh, no, everything's fine. It's just my eyes.
I see. Well, what shall I read?
This one.
Earthquake followed by fire was yesterday for 33 miles.
She read on. Her face was grave and slightly bored. She showed no surprise, no puzzlement. The words made sense to her. It was only I who couldn't understand them. Only I to whom they were a senseless jumble.
People learning...
Stop it! Stop it!
I don't want to hear any more.
Please,
please, just leave me alone, Nurse Curran. But Mrs. Wells...
Leave me alone, I tell you! Leave me alone!
That was the first discrepancy in my mind. I don't know how long I've been hearing the music. It has seemed all part of a dream. But then it began to unnerve me. It became frenzied and hating and evil. It sounded like all the demons of hell and the things of the night were after me.
Make it stop! Make it go away! Please! Please!
Well, what's the matter? Oh, it's all right now. It's all right. The music's gone away. The music. What music? For a few days after that, it didn't bother me. Not till early one evening. I'd rung for Nurse Curran twice. Where was she? I was very angry. I got out of bed and went across the room to the door. Mrs. Curran! She was walking down the hall, her back toward me. And she had my little daughter by the hand. Elsie, my baby. Her sailor hat was bobbing over her curls as she skipped. She had on a blue flouncy dress and the long white stockings and Mary Jane she loved to wear. Elsie! Elsie, darling! Why didn't they stop? They walked right on as if I hadn't spoken. Nurse! They turned the corner, then out of my sight. I began to run.
Do you hear me? Stop, Mrs. Curran. I want to talk to you.
Why, whatever is the matter, Mrs. Wells? Where's Elsie?
Elsie?
Yes, my daughter. I saw you walking down the hall with her, and then you turned this corner, and now she's gone. Where is she?
I assure you, Mrs. Wells, I was with no one. As a matter of fact, I didn't know you have a daughter. Oh. Well, I haven't anymore. She was drowned with her father 20 years ago. I knew I had to be more cautious after that, for if Nurse Curran ever suspected, she'd tell the doctor. And I'd seen enough of those walls when I was a girl.
Well, how are you, Sybil? How does it feel to be downstairs for dinner?
Oh, if you're ready to eat, I'll start serving. Why, Mrs. Curran, you needn't do that. Where's Mary?
Well, there wasn't much for her to do with you ill, Mrs. Wells, so when she asked to visit her sister for a few weeks, I didn't want to disturb you with details.
Oh, I see. That's all right, Mrs. Curran.
Then I'll get the soup.
Sybil, I've been worried about you.
Worried? Really?
You're not recuperating as quickly as you should. And, well, Curran's been telling me things
Yes, what has she said?
Oh, nothing much, really, but perhaps you're a bit more ill than we thought.
So she had noticed. I must be careful, very careful. Whatever happens, I must never let them send me there.
I said, will you have your soup, Mrs. Wells?
Oh, yes, please.
And you, Doctor?
Yes, thank you.
I took my first spoonful and could barely swallow it. The soup tasted far too salty. I was about to remark as much to the doctor when he said...
Delicious soup, sir.
Delicious? Oh, of course, George. Of course.
Sybil, what's wrong? You've hardly touched a thing all through dinner.
Well, I guess I'm just not very hungry. Salt. Everything tasted of salt. First my sight, then my hearing, and now even this sense was playing me false. How long could I go on hiding what was happening to me? I think I should have resigned myself to insanity. If the very next afternoon I hadn't wakened early from my nap. I wanted some warm milk, and when Mrs. Curran didn't answer my ring, I went down to the kitchen myself. Nurse Curran, is that you? Oh, it was a child. A little blonde girl who greatly resembled my daughter. She was playing with a toy tea set.
Mother isn't here right now. She's gone to the village for some groceries. Would you like to have tea with me? It's only make-believe, of course.
Mrs. Curran is your mother?
Yes, I'm Jean.
She never told me she had a daughter, nor that the child was living in my house with her.
Here's your tea. Sugar or cream? Oh, I forgot. You only take salt in your food.
I only take salt? What do you mean, dear? I don't quite understand.
Oh, my mother explained to me. I asked her why she put so much salt in everything she brought you to eat last night. And that's what she said, that you only take salt in
Jeannie,
your food.
Jeannie, are you sure of that?
Yes, of course. I know who you are. You're Mrs. Wells, the funny lady we had to play a game with.
What kind of a game, Jeannie?
Well, dressing me in those funny clothes Mother found in the attic. Not looking around when you called to us. And then, when we turned the corner, I had to pop right into the linen closet and not make a sound until Mother called. It was like hide and seek. Only you didn't find me.
Last I knew, I was not going mad. I had been terrified, blundering in the dark against an unknown opponent. But the game was clear to me now, and the rules, and the tricks, and most vital of all, my foe. Nurse Curran had tried to drive me mad, was still trying, but I could fight her. I had to fight her, for the sake of my sanity.
Mommy now.
Now, Jeannie, listen to me. Your mother mustn't know I was down here talking to you.
Why, Mrs. Wells? Why shouldn't I tell her? Why, Mrs. Wells? Why shouldn't I tell her?
Well, it's a game, Jeannie. It's like that hide-and-seek we played, remember? Please promise you won't say anything about my seeing you this afternoon.
I promise. I promise, Mrs. Wells.
I needed patience now, and cunning. Mrs. Curran was trying to destroy my reason. I couldn't let her succeed. But I needed definite evidence. And then one day, a letter came. A letter? From me, Mrs. Curran?
Yes, it's postmarked New York City.
Well, now, who would be writing me from there? It's from my brother, Frank. He's coming to see me and bringing a friend of his along. Someone who can help me, he says.
When does he arrive, Mrs. Wells?
On the 24th, the 3:30 train.
Well, he didn't give you much warning. That's today, you know.
I wonder why he's coming.
You're his sister and you're ill. What better reason?
Frank and I have always loathed each other. He's not traveling all this way for affection's sake.
It might be nice if I met the train.
Well, if you think he'd appreciate it, you're very much mistaken. By the time you get there, he'll probably have chartered the most expensive car in town anyway. Frank's a spendthrift and a wastrel. He ran through his share of my father's estate before Daddy was cold in his grave.
Just the same, it would be a nice thing to do, wouldn't it, Mrs. Weld?
Well, you know where the car keys are, if you insist on being polite. Go ahead and meet him. Yes?
Special delivery for Mrs. Agnes Curran.
That's your nurse, ain't it, Miss Wells?
Oh, yes, it is. I'll take it, Postman. She's not in right now.
I'm awfully sorry this is late, ma'am. But you see, one of our sorters put it in the regular mail route bag, and I only just discovered it.
Oh, I don't suppose there's any great harm done.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope not. Well, goodbye, ma'am.
Goodbye. I shut the door quickly and stood turning the letter over in my hands, for I had suddenly recognized the writing on the envelope. It was Frank's. And how could he know the name of my private nurse unless they knew each other? George hadn't corresponded with him, I was sure. He was aware of the hatred between us. I quickly ripped the envelope.
Dear Agnes, just a line to let you know of Jean's safe arrival. I think your fears that Sybil saw her and suspects you are groundless, but perhaps it is safest this way. I feel sure that by this time my dear sister has passed, or at any rate is near, the breaking point. I'm coming down next Thursday and will bring a specialist with me. I am certain that when she tells him of her hallucinations, shall we call them, he will have no hesitancy in declaring her insane.
There it was. The whole fiendish scheme. I held all the proof I needed right in my hand. I called George and asked him to come over as quickly as he could. And then I'd barely gotten upstairs when I heard the front door open.
Sure. Sybil!
Please, Mr. Courtney, she may have fallen asleep. She's still rather weak, you know.
Of course, I understand.
If you and Dr. Randall will make yourselves comfortable, I'll go upstairs and see how she is.
Splendid idea, nurse. Mrs. Kern, wasn't it?
Yes, sir.
If only George would come. Now the showdown was at hand, I was frightened. The nearer she came, the more frantically my heart beat. These next few minutes would decide so much for me. And I was alone. I felt sick with terror at having to face Mrs. Curran without George's comforting presence to reassure me, to make me know that everything would be all right. Because if I played my hand wrong now, if I couldn't convince the specialist of my sanity, I might never spend another night in this house.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I startle you, Mrs. Wells?
Well, I didn't hear you come in.
Your brother and Dr. Randall are in the parlor.
Oh, yes.
Well, don't you want to come down and see them?
We're not leaving this room just yet, Nurse Curran. Not until we settle a few things.
But I don't understand. Is there anything wrong, Mrs. Wells?
No. I'm just curious. Where did you have that trick newspaper printed?
What?
And how did you manage the music that night? Was it a phonograph record played from your room directly into the ventilator?
I don't get what you're talking about.
Oh, yes, you do. I've known for almost a week what you were up to, young lady. But I wasn't sure just why you were doing it or who was behind you. I am now.
You're crazy. I felt it all along. You're mad.
Oh, no, my dear. That was your aim, but you didn't succeed. You see this letter? The same stationery as the one I received today. The same handwriting, too. But this was written to you, Mrs. Curran. Fortunately, it wasn't delivered till after you'd left the house.
Give me that!
Oh, no! No. You'll have to kill me to get that. And I'd rather be dead than be in an institution. And we wouldn't want too loud a scene with that specialist downstairs, would we? He's not in my brother's pay. Is he?
No. All right. You win. I was working for Frank. He promised me a share in the estate.
Why, I can't believe it. I simply can't believe it.
George. Oh, thank heaven.
Now, Sybil, don't cry. You know, she almost had me fooled, Sybil.
Well, here's the proof, George. A letter that Frank wrote to her.
Dear Agnes, coming down next Thursday, declaring her insane. Sybil, you'd better go downstairs and bring Dr. Randall and your precious brother up here immediately.
10 minutes before, I'd gone down these steps, an old woman. But everything was different now. The shadow had been lifted. I was free again.
Well, well. My dear sister, Sybil.
Don't you dare sister me, Frank.
Why, Sybil, and here I brought Dr. Randall all this way to see you.
To see me, indeed. To declare me insane so you could get your foul claws on the rest of Father's money.
Sybil, what are you saying?
I don't think I understand, Mrs. Wells.
I told her she was...
Mad? Insane? Yes, I'm sure you did. And it's no fault of yours that I'm not. Dr. Randall, a few weeks ago I was very ill. My brother took advantage of that by planting Nurse Curran with me. She took all her orders from him, and those orders were to drive me insane.
Oh, I never heard of such a thing. I hadn't realized she was quite so badly off as this, Randall.
Oh, there's no use your blustering anymore, Frank. George Adams has written proof upstairs. The letter you sent Mrs. Curran...
Why, I never wrote her my whole life. I never met the girl till today.
Suppose we go and see what this is all about. Well, Courtney...
Oh, of course. As you say, Doctor.
Frank's face was gray. Perspiration beaded his brow as we went back up to my bedroom. George and Mrs. Curran were standing by the window quietly when I opened the door. Here they are, George.
Yes. Thank you, Sybil.
Well... Aren't you going to show Dr. Randall the letter?
What letter, Sybil?
The one Frank wrote Mrs. Curran. The one
there isn't any letter, Sybil.
But I gave it to you just before I went downstairs.
Mrs. Wells told me she had definite proof that Mr. Courtney was planning to railroad her.
It's terrible how convincing they can be. Isn't it, Randall? How very convincing.
I see.
George! George!
I could hardly bear to recognize those first signs, Dr. Randall. I've known Sybil for 30 years. She was very dear to me.
What did you do with it? Is it burned or torn into little pieces in your pocket, George? Where's that letter?
But I'm too much of a physician to blind myself to facts. She'll be happier.
Behind those walls, George, those walls where you and Frank put my father.
Come, Mrs. Wells, you'd better come with me.
No, you can't believe them. They're lying. No, please, no.
You'd better take a ride. No! And it's not safe to keep her here another day.
Yes, I'm afraid you're right. I'll talk to you with her. We can use my car.
Don't touch me, George. Don't you come near me. Get your hands off me.
Adams, let her go. Let me go inside her underway. Now, please, Mrs. Wells, take my arm. You know, we want to do what is best for you.
Dr. Randall, please, I swear this on my eternal soul. There was a letter. It was special delivery written by my brother Frank to Nurse Curran.
I wish I could believe you, Mrs. Wells. Watch your step, Sybil.
Don't be so solicitous, George. I'd rather you kill me than betray me as you have.
If there were one shred of evidence on your side, Mrs. Wells... One slightest bit of proof.
Oh, say, I beg your pardon, Miss Wells. I had to come all the way back again. I forgot to have you sign this slip on that special delivery for Mrs. Curran.
Adams, give me those car keys and turn around. We're going back into that house. I think we've got a few things to discuss.
Shadows and stillness, mystery weaves a spell of strangest fascination, charging the mind with doubt and fear. For mystery is a strange companion, a living memory. In the haunting hour.
History's lessons. Throughout history, surprise has had a leading role in military disasters. Today, an enemy capable of surprise air attack could leave chaos in his wake. That's why you should be in the Civilian Ground Observer Corps, volunteering a few hours a week to guard our skies. Be a ground observer. Contact your local civilian defense office.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call The Sunken Moment. A research firm that dealt in offshore oil exploration had lost a midget submarine, an accident which might have been caused by human error, mechanical failure, or sabotage on board. I learned that one of the men on board had pulled the necessary fence after he saw a green light flash indicating the hatches were closed. A second crewman had verified this. With these facts, you can determine whether it was mechanical failure, human error, or sabotage. In a moment, I'll explain.
Okay, we got a little bit of a break here. Be right back.
In the case of the sunken moment, sabotage on board is ruled out because the saboteur would have endangered his own life. Human error isn't the answer because of the double check. No, mechanical failure was the villain. Want to be a detective? Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mystery.
Well, it's the top of the second hour, and you may have noticed, if you're a regular listener, that the top of the second hour is nearly always a science fiction program. This show is no different. For our program tonight, we're going to go to Theater 5 for January the 14th of 1965, a program called The Wandering Spaceman. Theater 5 was ABC's attempt to revive radio drama during the early 60s. The name of the series was derived from the fact that it was on Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. And like nearly all of the programs that we run on night transmission, it's so easy to fall into that. Night transmissions is me, Gary Clinton. Like most of the episodes here on night transmissions, it's an anthology, with most episodes running about 20 minutes, plus commercials. Since we don't have any real commercials anymore, it's going to run about 20 minutes. They did do a good bit of science fiction, and fantasy, and horror, so you're going to hear them here pretty often. I admit the quality was a little uneven, and I also admit that the quality of the sound tonight leaves a bit to be desired. It isn't altogether terrible. I mean, if it was altogether terrible, I wouldn't play it. Now, I can't say the same for the quality of acting or script. The one tonight's pretty good. It's a good story that has its roots in the maritime traditions and lore of our own times and recent history. But even if it was, and I started to say if it was terrible, I would not play it. That's not really true. If it was terrible, I'd probably love it just as much. You see, as I intimated a little earlier in the show, I don't really discriminate between the good and the ugly. Because sometimes the ugly has a charm all of its own. And bad radio, I think, has its place here. Not to be made fun of. At least I don't want to make fun of it. But it's perfectly all right to have a bit of a chuckle. And on the other hand, I certainly don't want to pretend that every radio show done during the golden age of radio was wonderful and terrific. Some of them were just plain god-awful. Here I go rambling on again. I hope I haven't bored you too much. And anyway, I guess we should start this thing up.
First small stepping stone on the inevitable route to outer space. And what of the future, when the moon has become Luna Station? A transfer point on the well-traveled road to the planets and asteroids of our solar system. Will it gather a new crop of legends as deep and mysterious as the moon stories of 1,000 years ago? We cannot know, but we can guess. Theater 5 presents The Wandering Spaceman.
Thank you. I like this place. The drinks are honest. The girls are pretty. Although there are a lot worse hangouts around here on Luna Station.
Frank! Frank, I've been looking for you. When did you get in?
A little while ago. Take a seat, Lars. We were just talking about you.
Yeah, I can just guess the sort of things these baboons were saying. Come to the office with me, Frank. We can talk privately.
All right. See you, gentlemen.
Did you have a good trip, Frank?
Oh, as usual. The Mars run nowadays is almost as much of a milk run as the shuttle trip back to Earth. But how's it been going with you, my friend?
I missed this place.
Have you?
Sometimes I wonder about myself. Running a spaceman's diet carved out of the bedrock of the moon. It's a fine occupation for a grown man with a daughter.
Well, now, don't run yourself down, Lars. We astronauts need the spaceman's rest.
Maybe. And I swear someday I'll toss half these space bums out of this place. Never let them in the front door again.
Or you shouldn't let them get you down, Lars.
Hey, don't get Lars Toner down. Don't worry yourself about that. Still, know if I didn't have a daughter to support, I'd be tempted to pack up and find a job back on Earth. And at that, it might be better for her.
Well, you'd both be missed, Lars.
Especially Sally, eh?
Well,
don't be embarrassed, boy. I know how you feel about her.
Well, I guess everyone on Luna Station knows.
You're a good man, Frank. The sort of man I'd pick for her myself. A captain on a scheduled transport, sober, good future. Frank, let me push my nose into your business. Why haven't you asked her to marry you?
Well, I have, Lars.
And she?
Well, I guess she's not ready to settle down yet.
Yes, I was afraid of that. She's like her mother used to be, wild.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
You've heard about my wife, haven't you, Frank?
I've heard stories.
The stories are true. Whatever they say is true. She ran away from me, Frank. Ran away with a bum. Left her husband and her baby for a no-good pilot of a tramp freighter who set his course towards Venus, traveled too close to the sun and burned himself, his ship, and my woman to a blackened cinder. Oh. Sally was only 1 year old then. I raised her myself, watched her grow into a woman who looks like her mother did, and with her mother's blood.
She isn't her mother, sir.
Maybe she's not. But she has the same streak of wildness in her. I wish he'd marry a good man like you and settle down.
Well, I haven't given up on that.
No, no, of course you haven't, Frank. But you know what she does now? She comes to the rest and talks to the deep spacers, the captains who steer out beyond the asteroid belt. They have a certain look about them, Frank. A look like the one who... He, the man who took my Laura away.
Lars, you're making too much of this.
Maybe I am. Maybe I am. At any rate, I'd better get busy. Whatever you think of the spaceman's rest, it won't run itself.
Well, I'll go out with you.
Look, boy, there she is. You understand what I mean now?
What?
Sally. Look who she's with. He's one of them, all right. You can tell by looking at him. Tall, lean, with eyes you hardly dare to gaze into because of what they may have seen. She met him a week ago, and already she can't leave him alone. She's drawn to a man like a moth is drawn to a candle flame. I ought to go over there.
Take it easy. They're only talking. There's no crime in that.
Only talking, yes. But what are they talking about?
I see your father is staring at us, Miss Sally. I do not think he approves of our being together so much.
Poor Daddy. He's always worrying about me. My mother...
Yes, I've heard the story. It is a sad one. One of many sad tales a man can hear in his wanderings from planet to planet. Someone once said that human beings were meant to stay on their own world, and that any love affair that springs up away from Mother Earth is doomed from the start.
What a curious idea. You don't believe it, do you?
you?
Well, when you wandered for as long as I have, you simply don't know what to believe. But your father, did that you meet the same fate as your mother?
I think he really is. He says, I have my mother's blood in me. I think he really believes that he'll wake up some morning to find that I've followed some stranger into outer space.
And you? Could you do what your mother did?
I don't know. It would depend on the man, wouldn't it?
That young man. The one standing with your father.
Frank. Mm-hmm. He's really very nice. He'll be an important man one day. He's already captain of a ship on the Martian Run.
But he's not for you?
No, he's not. I sometimes wish he were. But he's not. Why am I telling you all this? A week ago, we were strangers.
And if I were your father, Miss Sally, I would worry about you in much the same way he does. You should be more wary of strangers.
But why? What can happen to me here?
You can say. A man from deep space might be anyone. He might be a dangerous criminal, or worse. He might even be a wandering spaceman.
Who?
A wandering spaceman. Now, don't tell me you haven't heard the tale.
No, I haven't.
Well, it also is a sad tale. The wandering spaceman was a captain in the early days of the Venus Run. He was young, bright, ambitious. Then one day, he met a girl. One very much like you, Miss Sally. He thought of her as the planets, the stars, the whole universe. Became engaged, and he had one more trip to make before they were to marry. While the captain was in space, the owner of the space line happened to come to Luna Station and met the girl. He was neither young nor handsome, but he did have one advantage. He was very, very rich. The girl left for Earth with him just 2 days before her captain was to arrive back on Luna. At first, he thought of going after them, killing them both. But he realized that that would solve nothing. So he cursed all women and all men too. He swore that he never wanted to marry, never wanted to look at another human being. The next morning he took a spacecraft out to a test run.
And
never was heard from again.
But what happened?
Some say that he wanders through the solar system, unable to land except once every 7 years. At that time, he's given a single week to find a woman who might share his loneliness.
And has he found one?
It's only a legend, remember.
But has he?
According to the story, no. You, Sally?
Me? But why?
I think you know why. Won't you sit down, Captain?
Oh, I forgot. You two don't know each other. Captain Von Graf, Captain Grassi.
Do join us.
No, I really don't have time. Sally, I'd like to speak with you alone for a few minutes.
I'm sure it can wait, Frank. In the meantime, do sit down. Captain Von Gross has been telling me the most fascinating story.
I'm sure he has.
It's about a space captain who has cursed all women and is condemned to wander between the planets.
Perhaps you've already heard the legend of the wandering spaceman captain. Wasn't there something else about his landing every so often in order to find a woman who would share his life with him? Hmm? This legend comes from Earth. It was told long before space travel was even heard of. Only then it was not a spaceship that the captain traveled in. It was an old-fashioned sailing ship in which he roamed the seven seas. And instead of the wandering spaceman, he was known as the Flying Dutchman. Quite true, Captain. Isn't it interesting how old tales like old truths keep cropping up over and over again?
I'm warning you, Captain, to stay away from Miss Toner.
I have no interest in getting into a brawl with you, sir.
Perhaps I'd better leave before the lady is furthest.
Wait a minute. Frank, let go of me. Captain Von Graf? Mitchell?
Wait a minute. Sally, come back here. Sally!
Mitchell, wait for me.
You want me, Miss Sally?
I'm so sorry for what happened to Frank. When I see him again, I'll...
Oh, don't be too hard on the young man, Sally. I can't blame him for what he did. If I had a girl such as you...
But I'm not his girl. I've already told you that.
And you're so literal, my Sally. Very well, if I admire the girl like you, if I hope to have a girl like you, then I would not be happy to see you with a man like myself. Sally, we have been seen together far too much over the past week for your friend's peace of mind or for your father's, for that matter.
And why shouldn't I be seen with him?
Use your own good judgment, Sally. What do you know of me? Only that I am captain of the Stranger, the tramp freighter, doing odd jobs out among the larger asteroids. It's not a very good prospect for a lovely young girl.
No one thinks to bother to ask me what I think.
Yes, you are right, Sally. Well, what do you think?
I don't know. Except that I want to know more about you. You're unlike anyone I've ever known, Mitchell. Even the other deep spaces. Somehow I have the feeling that we were intended to meet.
Perhaps it is better that we won't be seeing any more of each other.
What do you mean?
I'm leaving today, Sally. My ship is repaired, and I must go back out there where I came from.
Must you? Can't you stay a second week at least?
No. No, I can't.
Take me with you, then.
Take you with me? What?
Take me with you. Take me into the space with you and let me wander with you through the vastness beyond Venus and Mars. Let me see for myself the loneliness of space.
The loneliness?
Please, Mitchell. I will walk you in the way. You'll hardly know you have me on board unless you want to.
No.
But why not?
No, no, Sally. I've said no. You are a silly, romantic child. Now, stay here on Luna Station where you belong. Or better still, if I were your father, I'd take you back to Earth where you can get those ridiculous notions out of your head.
Mitchell.
Sally, I mean it. You don't know who I am. You don't know what I am.
I think I do.
I'm like the wandering spaceman we were talking about. No one knows where I go or what I do. Sally, I travel into space and disappear for 7 years.
I know.
I'll say goodbye to you now, Sally. I'm going to the launching platform.
Goodbye.
Yes. You'll forget about me, Sally. You'll have to forget about me.
Kiss me once before you go.
Kiss you?
Yes. Just once before you go.
Sally, my Sally, if things were only different.
Yes.
Goodbye. Sally? Sally?
There you are. Your father's
worried sick. Van Graaff's due to take off within the hour, and he was worried that you decided to take off with him.
What?
To take off with him. Stow away if you had to.
Stow away.
Oh, come, Sally.
No. You go back, Frank. I want to be by myself for a few more minutes.
Where will you be?
Take Dad to the radar room. Van Graaff's ship is leaving, and I...
And you'll meet us there?
Of course. I'll meet you there.
But I don't understand. Why didn't you bring her with you?
Don't worry, Lars. She said she'd meet us in the radar room. I suppose she wants to watch Van Graaff's ship as it gradually moves off the screen.
Yes, I suppose. Oh. But there's something about all this I just don't like.
Well, here we are at any rate.
She's not here. I told you, Frank. I told you there was something wrong.
Well, we can't know if there's something.
She's on that man's ship, I tell you. I don't know how she got on board, but she did somehow. I tell you, she's there.
Well, if you're sure, we could have the ship searched.
Don't waste time, man. Do it.
Launching room? Launching room. This is Captain Gradley speaking. I want you to hold the countdown for the spaceship Stranger, bound for the asteroid. Captain's name is... What's that? Are you sure?
Yes.
Yes, of course. Thank you.
What is it?
It was just taking off as I was speaking.
I knew it.
We actually don't know she was on board.
Where else would she be? Turn up that number three screen to see if we can track a ship.
There. It's that bright blip over there. We can keep her in sight for 2 or 3 hours.
I see it. It's starting the elliptical course towards the asteroid belt.
Look. What happened?
The blip. What happened to the blip?
It's gone.
But where? Oh, how did it go?
No. Let me see if I can find it on another screen. Could there have been an accident? A meteorite? An explosion? Something inside the ship?
No, I don't think so. If it was, it would have showed up on the screen. No, Jay, it just disappeared. One instant it was there, and the next instant, what? It's as if it vanished out of time and space as we know it.
What are you saying, Lars?
Remember what you were telling me. He was talking to Sally about.
Not the wandering spaceman, but that's
like the old Flying Dutchman, you said. Van Graaff is a Dutch name.
Wandering Spaceman, written by Mort Golding and directed by Ted Bell. In the cast, Donald Buca, Jeff David, Francis Spanier, and David Kerman. Audio engineer Marty Folia. Sound technician Ed Blaney. Script editor Jack C. Wilson. Original music by Alexander Vlastovchenko. Orchestra under the direction of Glenn Osser. Executive producer for Theater 5, Ted Bell. We invite your comment. Write to Theater 5, New York 23, New York. That's Theater 5, New York 23, New York. This is Fred Foy speaking.
Another 5-minute mystery.
Lieutenant.
There you are, Mr. Campbell. I've been waiting for you very anxiously since your call.
I hurried down here as fast as I could.
Mr. Campbell, if your evidence can give me a clue to the identity of Mr. Martin's killer, we'll break this case wide open.
Lieutenant, it's not an easy thing for me to bear. First, my partner was killed, and now with this photograph I'm putting on your desk, I condemn as the murderer.
His wife? Good heavens. Why didn't you show me this sooner?
I thought you might suspect her and solve the case, and I would have been able to remain silent.
Look at this picture. It's the perfect evidence. His body on the floor in front of the couch and she leaning over him with a gun still in her hand. Why, this will send her to the chair.
I know. It wasn't easy for me to give it to you.
How on earth did you ever get it?
Well, I had an appointment with my partner at a little after 11 p.m. at his house.
Mm-hmm.
When I came up the walk, I was surprised to see that the house was dark.
Oh, yeah.
You see, you must pass the large bay window in the living room when coming up the walk. The room was very dark, but by the faint light from some burning coals in the fireplace, I could see Mr. Martin's body lying in front of the large couch.
You could.
Yes. I saw my partner's wife come into the room. She had a gun in her hand.
Well, how did you get the picture?
Well, I've always been a camera enthusiast. I happened to have a small box camera with me, and without her noticing me, I took a picture of the room.
It's really a remarkable photograph.
I've kept it hidden for several days, but when you found no trace of the murderer, I decided that you would have to have it.
I'm glad you did, Mr. Campbell. It isn't exactly safe to withhold evidence, but now we have it, and it looks like the Martin case is closed.
Yes?
Mr. Campbell, there's a gentleman from the police department to see you.
Oh, send him in. Always glad to help the police. Well, hello, Lieutenant. It's good to see you.
Sorry to bother you, Mr. Campbell. It's about the Martin case.
Oh, but I thought the case was closed. You've arrested Mrs. Martin, haven't
you? Yes, but there are some points about the case that still puzzle me.
Really? But you have the evidence in black and white.
But have I? Will the jury accept a picture? You've heard of process shots, haven't you?
No, I don't believe I have.
You're lying, Mr. Campbell. That picture you gave me was a phony. And I can prove that your whole expedition that night was a contrived fairy tale.
How does the police lieutenant know that Campbell lied in his story? In just a moment, we'll know, but first...
I was sitting in the kitchen of a small country town hotel. We had come into the German kitchen not to fraternize, that strictly forbidden practice, but because we had seen a large radio set there and wanted to hear the BBC news at 9 o'clock. It took us some time to find London on the dial, and the announcer had already begun the bulletin when we brought his voice loud and clear into the room. The hotel family was already there when we came in. The old white-haired man who watched us fearfully, I think the Germans had told him terrible stories of what we would do, his two not unattractive daughters, by no means frightened, and his grey-haired wife who sat knitting at the table. A woman friend was visiting them, one of the smarter women of the little town, with her hair caught up in a bright turban and wearing what looked to me very like fully fashioned silk stockings. They, at least the women, were ready and anxious to talk, but we made it pretty clear that we had come in only to hear the wireless. As we sat listening to the news about this battle area, I watched the reaction of this German family which had been engulfed in the fighting a very short time before, and could hear it going on now if we turned off the set. They were listening quite intently, understanding no English, but catching the German place names as Freddy Griswold mentioned them. And as I watched them, a thought struck me. This was a recital from London of our success, of the growing and spreading defeat of their country. And yet there was not one sound or sign of regret on their faces. No shock, no despair, no alarm. They just picked up what was said, checked it on the map, and noted it, just as if they were a bunch of neutrals hearing all about somebody else. And indeed, I believe that that's what many of these frontline German people are. Neutrals in their own country.
Now, back to our story.
Mr. Campbell, you don't think I fell for that story about your being a camera hound and accidentally being on the spot for the picture of the year, do you? For if you were a photographer, as you claim, you'd know that the feeble light from a dying fire is hardly enough with which to take a picture in a darkened room. If you'd used a flash, she would have seen you, but that was impossible because she wasn't even in that room. But you were, Mr. Campbell. And you killed your partner and dummied up this fake picture to throw a blame on his wife. Snap judgment's supposed to be a dangerous thing, Campbell. You proved it.
Another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
One, two, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock. 5, 7, 6, 9, 8 o'clock rock. 9, 13, 14, 17, or, just a minute. Or to hell with it.
The Next Logical Step. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Bill Russom. The Next Logical Step by Ben Bova. Ordinarily, the military at least wants to have the others know the final details of their war plans. But, logically, there would be times. I don't really see where this problem has anything to do with me, the CIA man said. And, frankly, there are a lot of more important things I could be doing. Ford, the physicist, glanced at General LeRoy. The general had that quizzical expression on his face, the look that meant he was about to do something decisive. Would you like to see the problem firsthand? The general asked, innocently. The CIA man took a quick look at his wristwatch. Okay, if it doesn't take too long. It's late enough already. It won't take very long, will it, Ford? The general said, getting out of his chair. Not very long, Ford agreed. Only a lifetime. The CIA man grunted as they went to the doorway and left the general's office. Going down the dark, deserted hallway, their footsteps echoed hollowly. I can't overemphasize the seriousness of the problem, General LeRoy said to the CIA man. 8 ranking members of the general staff have either resigned their commissions or gone straight to the violent ward after just one session with the computer. The CIA man scowled. Is this area secure? General LeRoy's face turned red. This entire building is as secure as any edifice in the free world, mister, and it's empty. We're the only living people inside here at this hour. I'm not taking any chances. Just want to be sure. Perhaps if I explain the computer a little more, Ford said, changing the subject, you'll know what to expect. Good idea, said the man from CIA. We told you that this is the most modern, most complex, and delicate computer in the world. Nothing like it has ever been attempted before, anywhere. I know that they don't have anything like it, the CIA man agreed. And you also know, I suppose, that it was built to simulate actual war situations. We fight wars in this computer. Wars with missiles and bombs and gas. Real wars, complete down to the tiniest detail. The computer tells us what will actually happen to every missile, every city, every man. Who dies, how many planes are lost, how many trucks will fail to start on a cold morning. Whether a battle is won or lost, General LeRoy interrupted. The computer runs these analyses for both sides, so we can see what's happening to them, too. The CIA man gestured impatiently. War game simulations aren't new. You've been doing them for years. Yes, but this machine is different, Ford pointed out. It not only gives a much more detailed war game, it's the next logical step in the development of machine-simulated war games. He hesitated dramatically. Well, what is it? We've added a variation of the electroencephalograph. The CIA man stopped walking. The electro-what? Electroencephalograph. You know, a recording device that reads the electrical patterns of your brain, like the electrocardiograph. Oh. But you see, we've given the EEG a reverse twist. Instead of using a machine that makes a recording of the brain's electrical wave output, we've developed a device that will take the computer's readout tapes and turn them into electrical patterns that are put into your brain. I don't get it. General LeRoy took over. You sit at the machine's control console. A helmet is placed over your head. You set the machine in operation. You see the results. Yes, Ford went on. Instead of reading rows of figures from the computer's printout, you actually see the war being fought. Complete visual and auditory hallucinations. You can watch the progress of the battles, and as you change strategy and tactics, you can see the results before your eyes. The idea, originally, was to make it easier for the general staff to visualize strategic situations, General LeRoy said. But everyone who's used the machine has either resigned his commission or gone insane, Ford added. The CIA man cocked an eye at LeRoy. You've used the computer. Correct. And you have neither resigned nor cracked up. General LeRoy nodded. I called you in. Before the CIA man could comment, Ford said, The computer's right inside this doorway. Let's get this over with while the building is still empty. They stepped in. The physicist and the general showed the CIA man through the room-filled rows of massive consoles. It's all transistorized and sub-miniaturized, of course, Ford explained. That's the only way we could build so much detail into the machine and still have it small enough to fit inside a single building. A single building? Oh, yes. This is only the control section. Most of this building is taken up by the circuits, the memory banks, and the rest of it. They showed him finally to a small desk, studded with control buttons and dials. The single spotlight above the desk lit it brilliantly, in harsh contrast to the semi-darkness of the rest of the room. Since you've never run the computer before, Ford said, General LeRoy will do the controlling. You just sit and watch what happens. The general sat in one of the well-padded chairs and donned a grotesque headgear that was connected to the desk by a half dozen wires. The CIA man took his chair slowly. When they put one of the bulky helmets on him, he looked up at them, squinting a little in the bright light. This isn't going to, well, do me any damage, is it? My goodness, no, Ford said. You mean mentally? No, of course not. You're not on the general staff, so it won't affect you the way it did the others. Their reaction had nothing to do with the computer, per se. Several civilians have used the computer with no ill effects, General LeRoy said. Ford has used it many times. The CIA man nodded, and they closed the transparent visor over his face. He sat there and watched General LeRoy press a series of buttons, then turn a dial. Can you hear me? The general's voice came muffled through the helmet. Yes, he said. All right, here we go. You're familiar with Situation 121? That's what we're going to be seeing. Situation 121 was a standard war game. The CIA man was well acquainted with it. He watched the general flip a switch, then sit back and fold his arms over his chest. A row of lights on the desk console began blinking on and off. 1, 2, 3. Down to the end of the row, then back to the beginning again. On and off. On and off. And then, somehow, he could see it. He was poised, incredibly, somewhere in space, and he could see it all in a funny, blurry, double-sided, dreamlike way. He seemed to be seeing several pictures and hearing many voices, all at once. It was all mixed up, and yet it made a weird kind of sense. For a panicked instant, he wanted to rip the helmet off his head. It's only an illusion, he told himself, forcing calm on his unwilling nerves. Only an illusion. But it seemed strangely real. He was watching the Gulf of Mexico. He could see Florida off to his right, and the arching coast of the southeastern United States. He could even make out the Rio Grande River. Situation 121 started, he remembered, with the discovery of missile-bearing enemy submarines in the Gulf. Even as he watched the whole area, as though perched on a satellite, he could see, underwater and close up, the menacing shadowy figure of a submarine gliding through the crystal blue sea. He saw, too, a patrol plane as it spotted the submarine and sent an urgent radio warning. The underwater picture dissolved in a bewildering burst of bubbles. A missile had been launched. Within seconds, another burst, this time a nuclear depth charge, utterly destroyed the submarine. It was confusing. He was every place at once. The details were overpowering, but the total picture was agonizingly clear. 6 submarines fired missiles from the Gulf of Mexico. 4 were immediately sunk, but too late. New Orleans, St. Louis, and three Air Force bases were obliterated by hydrogen fusion warheads. The CIA man was familiar with the opening stages of the war. The first missile fired at the United States was the signal for whole fleets of missiles and bombers to launch themselves at the enemy. It was confusing to see the world at once. At times, he could not tell if the fireball and mushroom cloud was over Chicago or Shanghai, New York or Novosibirsk, Baltimore or Budapest. It did not make much difference, really. They all got it in the first few hours of the war, as did London and Moscow, Washington and Peking, Detroit and Delhi, and many, many more. The defensive systems on all sides seemed to operate well, except that there were never enough anti-missiles. Defensive systems were expensive compared to attack rockets. It was cheaper to build a deterrent than to defend against it. The missiles flashed up from submarines and railway cars, from underground silos and stratospheric jets. Secret ones fired off automatically when a certain airbase command post ceased beaming out a restraining radio signal. The defensive systems were simply overloaded. And when the bombs ran out, the missiles carried dust and germs and gas. On and on. For 6 days and six fire-lit nights, launch, boost, coast, re-enter, death. And now it was over, the CIA man thought. The missiles were all gone. The airplanes were exhausted. The nations that had built the weapons no longer existed. By all the rules he knew of, the war should have been ended. Yet the fighting did not end. The machine knew better. There were still many ways to kill an enemy. Time-tested ways. There were armies fighting in four continents. Armies that had marched overland, or splashed ashore from the sea, or dropped out of the skies. Incredibly, the war went on. When the tanks ran out of gas, and the flamethrowers became useless, and even the prosaic artillery pieces had no more rounds to fire, there were still simple guns and even simpler bayonets and swords. The proud armies, the descendants of the Alexanders and Caesars and Temujins and Wellingtons and Grants and Rommels, relived their evolution in reverse. The war went on. Slowly, inevitably, the armies split apart into smaller and smaller units, until the tortured countryside that so recently had felt the impact of nuclear war once again knew the tread of bands of armed marauders. The tiny savage groups, stranded in alien lands, far from the homes and families that they knew to be destroyed, carried on a mockery of war, living off the land, fought their own countrymen if the occasion suited, and revived the ancient terror of hand-wielded, personal, one-head-at-a-time killing. The CIA man watched the world disintegrate. Death was an individual business now, none the better for no longer being mass-produced. In agonized fascination, he saw the myriad ways in which a man might die. Murder was only one of them. Radiation, disease, toxic gases that lingered and drifted on the once innocent winds. And, finally, the most efficient destroyer of them all, starvation. 3 billion people, give or take a meaningless 100 million, lived on the planet Earth when the war began. Now, with the tenuous thread of civilization burned away, most of those who were not killed by the fighting itself succumbed inexorably to starvation. Not everyone died, of course. Life went on. Some were lucky. A long darkness settled on the world. Life went on for a few, a pitiful few, a bitter, hateful, suspicious, savage few. Cities became pest holes. Books became fuel. Knowledge died. Civilization was completely gone from the planet Earth. The helmet was lifted slowly off his head. The CIA man found that he was too weak to raise his arms and help. He was shivering and damp with perspiration. "Now you see," Ford said quietly, "why the military men cracked up when they used the computer." General LeRoy, even, was pale. How can a man with any conscience at all direct a military operation when he knows that will be the consequence? The CIA man struck up a cigarette and pulled hard on it. He exhaled sharply. "Are all the war games like that? Every plan?" "Some are worse," Ford said. "We picked an average one for you. Even some of the brushfire games get out of hand and end up like that." "So, what do you intend to do? Why did you call me in?" What can I do? You're with the CIA, the general said. Don't you handle espionage? Yes, but what's that got to do with it? The general looked at him. It seems to me that the next logical step is to make damn certain that they get the plans to this computer. And fast. End of The Next Logical Step by Ben Bova. Recording by Bill Russom of TalkingTraffic.org.
Well, that's another fine night transmissions in the can. So, well, it's almost in the can. Before I go, I want to mention that you can write me, if you're so inclined, at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. I also want to mention that the website, www.nighttransmissions.com, is out there on the internet. And there's a good deal of ancillary material there, more details about the shows, and even the occasional link to go a little bit deeper into the history of the show. Some people actually think it's worth a visit. Well, I don't want to lie to you. Nobody's ever actually told me that. On second thought, why shouldn't I lie to you? I mean, everybody lies to us, huh? It's a wonderful place. Free pretzels and beer. Go, go. You'll like it there. Anyway, this is the end of what I like to call the dramatic presentation portion of Night Transmissions. So we'll spend the next few minutes just listening to some music. Usually there's no theme to the music, it's just stuff that I like and kind of hope you'll like. Anyway, take care of yourself. I'm Gary Clinton, and you're whoever the hell you are.
Come, all you colliers far and near, I'll tell of a cockfight when and where. Out on the moors I heard him say, between the black and the bonny grey. First come in was the oldham lads, and they come with all the money they had. The reason why they all did say, the black's too big for the bonny grey. It's into the pub to take a sup, and the cockfight it was soon made up. For £20 these cocks will play the charcoal black and the bonny grey. The oldham lads did shouting around, I'll lay you a quid to half a crown. If our black cock he gets fair play, he'll make mincemeat of the bonny grey. So the cocks they at it, and the grey was tossed, and the oldham lad said, bah, you lost us, call you lads. We went right pale and wished we'd fought for a barrel of ale. But the cocks they at it, 1, 2, 3, and the charcoal black got struck in the eye, and they picked him up, but he wouldn't play, and the cockfight went to a bonny grey. With the silver breast and the silver wing, he's fit to fight in front of the king. So hip hooray, 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 away we carried our bonny grey.
Oh, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. God said no, Abe said what? God said you can do what you want, Abe, but next time you see me coming, you better run. Well, Abe said, where do you want this killing done? God said, all on Highway 61. Well, Georgia Sam, he had a bloody nose. Welfare department, they wouldn't give him no clothes. They asked poor Howard, where can I go? Howard said, there's only one place I know. Sam said, tell me quick, man, I got to run. Oh, Howard just pointed with his gun and said, that way down Highway 61. Well, Mac the finger said to Louis the King. I got 40 red, white, blue shoestrings and 1,000 telephones that don't ring. Do you know where I can get rid of these things? And Louis the King said, let me think for a minute, son. Then he said, yes, I think it can be easily done. Just take everything down to Highway 61. Now the fifth daughter on the 12th night told her first father that things weren't right. My complexion, she says, is much too white. He said, come here and step into the light. He says, you're right. Let me tell the second mother this has been done. But the second mother was with the seventh son, and they were both out on Highway 61. He was very bored, trying to create a next world war. He found a promoter who nearly fell off the floor. He said, I never engaged in this kind of thing before, but yes, I think it can be very easily done. We'll just put some bleachers out in the sun and have it on Highway 61.
I'm and I think I'm gonna love you for a long, long time. Caught in my fears, thinking back the tears. I think I'm gonna miss you.